So getting started, I'm going to start with something easy, right? If I were to ask you to describe or to define love, what would you tell me? Now, obviously, you're not going to answer out loud just this moment, but I want you to think about that. How is it that I would define love? According to Webster's Dictionary and dictionary.com, love is described as an intense feeling of deep affection. In other words, love is what one feels. And perhaps that's true on some level, but I think it's a lot more complex than that, don't you think? I mean, love is hard to define, but it can also be even more difficult to experience because there's a lot that comes with it. There's warmth, but there's also pain. There's joy, and yet there's uncertainty and vulnerability. Love is a many splendored things, and yet, as the Jay Giles band once sung, sometimes love stinks. For thousands of years, we've written about it and we've sung about it and we have felt its effects, but still, it's not always so easy to wrap our arms around, is it? In fact, to more fully conceptualize what love is, the ancient Greeks came up with four different words to describe it. The first, storge, which is a feeling of fondness or natural affection. It would be like family love, the kind of love that a mother or a father has for their son or daughter. And then there's philia, which is brotherly love. This might be love shared between friends, people who share the same values and experiences and ideals. And then there's eros, which is romantic love. And then finally, agape, which is God's divine love. It is the kind of love that knows no conditions. And it's the kind of love that we'll be looking at today. So we're in week three of our series now, Hey Siri. And in the beginning, I told you that there are a lot of things that Siri can help us with. There are a lot of questions that Siri, when we're stuck, can help us answer, but there are some things that even our digital personal computer assistant cannot help us with. And so the premise for this series was, is I wanted to give you five basic questions which would serve as a grid so that when you were facing important decisions, you could ask these questions of yourself, and it would help you to increase your level of clarity, to improve your level of confidence, and also, most importantly, reduce your level of regret. And so as we think back 2 weeks, this is week number three, the very first question that I asked you to consider was the integrity question. It was the question that said, am I being honest with myself? And then pausing for a moment and asking ourselves, really? Am I being honest with myself, really? Because there's so many occasions where looking back, we would say to ourselves, if only I were just more honest, I would have made a different decision. And then last week was the maturity question. And that is, what is the wise thing in this situation for me to do? How I think back about all of the foolish decisions I've made over the course of my life, if I would have just stopped and said, is that smart? Is that a wise thing for me to do? Well, that was last week. This week, as we come to question number three, it's the relationship question. And this question may be the most clarifying and at the same time, the most terrifying of them all. This question, when asked and answered, has the potential to enhance the quality of every single relationship we have. It could be an absolute game changer in our life and also in the world. And we'll get to what that question is in just a little bit. Now, throughout Jesus's entire ministry, he hinted that something new was on the horizon, something designed to replace the status quo in first century Palestine. While many were seeking political reform, Jesus had something different in mind, something bigger, something more inclusive. And every hint or illusion was designed to create a sense of expectation in the hearts and minds of his followers. So when he entered Jerusalem on his final visit, crowds lined up to greet and celebrate his arrival because in their minds, their king had come. Not unlike many today, they were looking for a political revolution. And Jesus had their attention, but they didn't understand his intentions. Even his 12 apostles, those who had walked with him and lived with him and spent so much time with him, were confused as well regarding his ultimate aim. Right up to the end, they were jockeying for positions of power in the soon-to-be revitalized kingdom of Israel. So on the night of his arrest, when he shared the final meal with his closest friends, Jesus made his intentions crystal clear. Somewhere between the prediction of Judas's betrayal and Peter's denial, he said to them this, "My children." And that seems odd to me. Like, these are grown men, and yet Jesus is calling them, I think, in a tender way, a term of affection. He says, "My children." And we'll get this more clearly because, as we will see as he moves through the night and continues his discussions and things play out, perhaps he's calling them his children because that's what they're acting like. "My children, I will be with you only a little while longer. And as I told the Jewish leaders, you will look for me, but you will not be able to come where I am going." But it was almost like once he told them this, that they didn't hear a single word that he said. On the precipice of a revolution, they had to be asking themselves, why is he leaving now? The kingdom of Israel is about to be restored. What is he talking about? Jesus continued. He said, "So now, I'm going to give you a new command." New command? They didn't need any new commands. They needed to be making plans. And who was he to add to the big two anyway? To love God and love your neighbor as yourself. Only God had the authority to add any commands. But as it turns out, Jesus wasn't adding a command to the existing list. He was doing something far more radical. He was actually replacing the existing commands. As he continued, he says, "A new command I give you, love one another." He wasn't commanding them like Webster's or dictionary.com would tell us. He wasn't commanding them to feel something. He was commanding them to do something. And what was he asking them to do? The concept of love would have been incredibly familiar to them at this point, but what they wouldn't have been familiar with are the words that followed when he said, "Just as I have loved you, so you should love one another." Now, if you were one of the men seated around the table that night, this would have been very, extremely personal for you. They probably would have thought back over the previous 3 years that they had shared with Jesus and perhaps been transported back in time to a particular moment when Jesus had loved them particularly well. He could have called them out one by one. "Hey, Matthew, do you remember what you were up to the very first time we met? Do you remember what you were doing when I called you from your tax collecting booth?" And Matthew would have thought to himself, "Yeah, I remember. I remember that I was despised by most of the people I grew up with. I remember that I was working for a trader, and every day I went to work, how bad I felt about myself, but yet not bad enough to stop skimming off the top and making personal gain from the people who I once called friend. I remember what it felt like in a day and time where everybody around me hated my guts. And yet you saw something in me and you called it out and you invited me to come and be a part of your revolution, to be a part of your special community. You made me feel welcome. You made me feel special." Yeah, I remember exactly how that felt. And then Jesus would have said, "Exactly, Matthew. And so I want you to extend the same grace to everyone you meet for the rest of your life. And he could have worked his way around the table and told each of them, recounting the stories when he first connected with them, inviting them to love others the way that he had loved them, extending the grace that he had extended to them, to others. For the rest of their lives, I want you to do this, he would challenge them. They hadn't even gotten to his greatest act of love, because on the following day, he would put on a demonstration of love that would absolutely take their breath away. And then he continued, and your love for one another will be the thing that actually proves to the world that you belong to me, that you're my disciple, that you're my student, that I'm your teacher, that you're following my way. Jesus pointed to one specific thing that was to be the identifying characteristic of all of his followers, and that is the way that they loved. This new command was to serve as the unifying and defining characteristic for his new movement. It was to be the standard against which all behavior was to be measured for those who call him Lord. His primary concern was not that they feel something, but he insisted that they do something. They were to love as he loved. Jesus' followers would demonstrate their devotion to God by putting the person next to them in front of them. His imminent sacrifice would compel his disciples to eventually take up their own crosses and to follow him. And so the question that we are to consider this morning, question number three, comes from the heart of Jesus's new command. And the question is simply this: in this situation, what does love require of me? What does love require of me? This question should inform every relationship that we have. It's so simple, but it's so demanding. It calls all of us into account. It is our judge and our jury. It should inform how we date, how we relate, how we parent, how we manage, how we coach. It should form a perimeter around what we say and what we do in our roles as spouses and coworkers and neighbors. And when unsure of what to say or do, we must ask the question, in this situation, what does love require of me? And then do unto others as it has been done unto us, to love as we have been loved. What does that look like? Well, last week I told you that my son Josh had graduated from the University of Delaware, but what I didn't tell you is what I think you need to hear as it relates to this particular theme. So last Thursday, when my wife and I and my youngest son, Eli, and my daughter, Gabrielle, went down to be with Josh, we drove down on Thursday to help him pack up his apartment and move out. Graduation wasn't until Friday, but we didn't want to combine the two. We felt like if we could go down, spend some time, pack up the truck, get everything home, and then drive back on Friday, that it would just make Friday graduation day much easier and much simpler. And so that's what we did. Thursday was a great day. We drove down. The weather was good. We packed everything up. We took some pictures. We had a dinner. It was just a nice day. We drove back that night. And then the next morning, we were to wake up and drive back again. Now, it's 2 hours there and it's 2 hours back. So sum total, it's 4 hours. It's not a huge deal. It's not short, but it's not long either. But if you will remember, last week's forecast was for storms. It was supposed to be a very miserable day. And it turns out towards the end that that is exactly what it was. Now, to jump back for just a moment, when we were with Josh on Thursday, part of what his responsibility was to make sure that his parents could come and see his graduation was he was supposed to secure two tickets. Not everybody was able to, well, everybody was able to have two, but nothing more than two. We looked online because he ultimately forgot to get tickets to us. And so we were thinking that we were going to miss his graduation. And I was trying to play it cool, but like, you know, it'd been 4 years and there were moments where we weren't all that sure that he was going to graduate. So like, I felt like we had invested a lot in this and I wanted to be at this graduation. Long story short, he was able to finagle some tickets and we were able to go. But by the time we woke up on Friday morning, the forecast was miserable. And so there was a huge storm that was supposed to be coming into town in Newark around 2. And I thought to myself, as I looked at my phone, that this storm was going to stay in town until about 10. So from 2 to 10, heavy gusting winds, rain, lightning, thunder. And I thought to myself, I wish that he wasn't able to finagle the tickets and we didn't have to go. I was thinking to myself, I wish this was on him and not on me to say, I really don't want to be there. And so as I was contemplating going back and forth with my wife, I said, have you seen this forecast? And she said, yep, it doesn't look so hot, does it? And I said, no, it doesn't. I said, what do you think about, we had such a great day yesterday. We took pictures, we spent time, we had dinner. What do you think about just passing on graduation? And I couldn't believe I was saying that because less than 24 hours prior, I so wanted to be there. And she was like, what are you talking about? And I said, well, the forecast says we're going to be sitting in driving rain through the course of the day and his graduation. It's going to be miserable. We won't even be able to hear them call his name. We're going to be a soaking wet. We're going to have to get back in our car and drive back 2 hours after that. We're probably going to end up sick. And I went on and on about all the reasons that we shouldn't do it. And she was like, you know, we have to do this, right? And I said, we do? And she said, yeah, we have to do this. And she said, but honestly, I'll let you off the hook. If you don't want to go, you don't have to go. But I'm going to go without you. I'd rather go with you, but I will go without you. And that was like a dagger to my heart. I was just thinking, ugh, I'm a terrible dad. I'm just a terrible dad. In that moment, all I was thinking about is how wet and miserable I was going to be. I wasn't thinking about my son. I wasn't thinking about how much of a hole that he dug early on in his time at Delaware and how hard he worked to get back to the place that he would graduate with the people that he started with. I wasn't thinking about the accomplishment. I wasn't thinking about him. I was thinking about me. I was putting myself ahead of him. I wasn't loving him the way that I had been loved. And it struck me, it took my wife to sort of like shake me into realizing like, I can fall into doing this with even the people I love the most, much less with people I don't even like. And I think to myself in an ongoing way, if only I would have been prepping last week's message during that time when I was asking myself this question that I'm asking myself this week and I'm asking you, what does love require of me? It would have been a no-brainer. But so often when I'm in a situation, I just think, what's going to be easiest? What's going to suit me? What does that person deserve? Why should I give them that when they've given me this? What does love look like? When it comes to relationships, love has to be patient. Paul tells us, love isn't pushy. It requires kindness. Love is doing for others what they cannot in that moment do for themselves. Love requires us to show honor to others. It never treats another person dishonorably, disgracefully, indecently. Because Jesus never treated anybody that way. From the tree, from the cross of his own death, with people who deserve nothing but curses, he blessed them and forgave them. Love requires selflessness. It requires sacrifice. It puts the needs and the interest of others ahead of our own. Love isn't easily angered. It isn't stirred up. It's not provoked. Instead, love absorbs, it puts the other person's story ahead of our own. It requires us to forgive, and it keeps no record of wrongs. Love always works to protect the relationship. It always trusts. It always hopes, and it always perseveres. And so, despite what others deserve, that's what love requires of us. When two parties embrace this ideal, there's virtually no obstacle that can't be overcome. What does love require of me? This singular command is how we make the world a better place. But the thing that I haven't said is that sometimes it just doesn't work. Sometimes we can give people what they need, not what they deserve. We can be kind. We can make sacrifices. We can forgive. We can persevere. We can do all of the right things. And sometimes the response in kind is to be nailed to a tree. But I think in Jesus's life and in his death, he shows us that that's what his kingdom is about. It's not political. It's centered around the ethic of love. And we are to love not as others deserve it, but as we have been loved. And so, question number three for us as we move into the rest of our day and into a new week is simply this: what does love require of me? I hope you'll ask it the next time you're ready to engage another argument, the next time you're ready to post or text or put something online that you would regret 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 5 hours later. I hope the next time that you're confronted relationally with making a decision that you may otherwise regret, I hope you'll stop long enough and ask yourself the question, what does love require of me? And then remember how you've been loved and respond in kind to the one in front of you. As you think about that, let's together pray. To ask the question, Lord, what does love require of me, is so challenging, and yet it is so important, so critical in our life with others. Much like the disciples could have remembered a point in time where you called them into something greater than themselves, I ask that you would help us to remember a point in time where you looked on us with favor, and by your grace, you called us into your new community. And I pray that as we remember that, and as we receive what you offer, that we would in turn give it to those who most need it. In the name of Christ, we pray. Amen.